Okay, good afternoon. I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It is Monday, March 6, 2017, and we are going to learn a lot about food safety and hear a bill to that effect, and come back to our old friend, the world of septic systems.
That's right.
And that, again, thanks to Everything Septic, we can thank our good Senator Roblin for that one.
That's right.
But before we do that, we have a work session on a bill that we heard last week, Senate Bill 805. I think we were going to do a work session on the cider bill as well, but some work needs to be done on that, a little amendment. So we put that off, and we can just do 805 and then our informational meeting and public hearings. So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 805. And Cheyenne, could you remind us what that is?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 805 was previously heard on March 2nd. It appropriates $9,400,000 out of the general fund to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission for the biennium that begins July 1st, 2017, to be expended for the Agricultural Experiment Station and Branch Stations, the Oregon State University Extension Service, and OSU Forest Research Laboratory Programs, declares emergency effective July 1st, 2017. There's no revenue impact, and a fiscal impact has been received and is posted on OLIS, and it has a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Vice Chair Olson.
Chair DeBrew, I move Senate Bill 805 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Olson has moved Senate Bill 805 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there discussion of this? Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none? So ordered, this bill will go to Ways and Means, where we hope it will be treated extremely favorably.
I will work very hard at that.
So with that, I'll close our work session on Senate Bill 805, and I will open our informational meeting on Federal Food Safety Modernization Act. Call up Lisa Hansen and Stephanie Page, please. Okay, great. So, Lisa, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
It's 2017. Good to have you.
Thank you. For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Thank you for the opportunity to visit with you a little bit about the Food Safety Modernization Act. With me, I have Stephanie Page, who is the director of our food safety program area and has been involved nationally working through many of the issues with this program, and also Lindsay Ng, who oversees our market certification programs and has probably the closest connection to the produce industry, which is one of the sectors that will be most greatly impacted by the Food Safety Modernization Act. So we are going to have Stephanie run through kind of a briefing on the act and then visit with you about Senate Bill 18.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Stephanie Page, Oregon Department of Agriculture. And I'll just start right into my slides. The Food Safety Modernization Act was passed by Congress in 2011, and its main goal is to take a more preventive approach to addressing foodborne illness. Certainly in the department, and I think in other states, we've seen some of the impacts not only to consumers, but to our ag and food industries of foodborne illness. We've seen the economic impacts to the industry, as well as some of the significant impacts to consumers. And so we, along with fellow state departments of agriculture, in large part supported FSMA. That's what I'll call the Food Safety Modernization Act for short, because it takes that more proactive approach. FDA engaged an extensive public engagement process when they proposed rules in 2013, We were highly involved in commenting on those, and many of our stakeholders were as well. FDA's come to the Pacific Northwest a couple of times to get even more detailed input and really see on the ground the impact of what they were proposing. And then in 2015 and 2016, FDA finalized each of those seven rules that it had proposed in 2013. So the first three rules listed here are really the ones where we see ourselves being involved in the department going forward, the main ones. Produce safety, preventive controls for human food, and that really deals with manufactured or processed food for humans, and then the animal food rule, which deals with manufactured foods for animals. And so again, those three rules not only impact our industry, but will have significant impacts and intersections with ODA programs. Our market access and certification program will be the lead in implementing the produce safety rule. So that's Lindsay's program area. Because they have significant on-farm produce safety experience with the voluntary fee for certification programs that they've operated. Food safety will act in a supporting role in that rule. And then on the human food side, we would take the lead in implementing the human food preventive controls rule. And that dovetails well with the existing work that our food safety program does working with processors. On the animal food side, we have a commercial feeds program within the animal health program at ODA, and so that program would likely have a role in implementing that rule. The timeline in implementing all of these varies by rule, and I think in your handouts or your documents, there's a complicated timeline showing when each of the rules takes effect for different business sizes. So that is a nice compact way to keep track of when all the rules take effect. One thing I'd like to mention is that there are delayed implementation dates for the ag water portion of the produce safety rule. And we're additionally grateful for that because FDA has agreed to take another look at that portion of the produce safety rule. I'll get into more in a minute, but we have some concerns about how the rule is currently worded. In terms of the impacts of these rules to Oregon agriculture and food, the cost estimates that you see on this slide were prepared by the Food and Drug Administration as part of its regulatory impact analysis. So as you can see, there are pretty significant costs depending on the farm and the business size. And I think one thing to note in addition to these costs is that some of the businesses that will be affected may be impacted by more than one rule. So there may be cumulative costs that apply to them.
Stephanie, can I ask, so what constitutes an exempt farm? What would exempt a farm from the rule?
Mr. Chair, there are several exemptions in the rule. There's an exemption for farms that earn less than $25,000 a year in produce sales. And then there's also an exemption for firms that sell, I believe it's less than $500,000 a year in food sales, with over 50% of those sales going directly to the end users. So that could be directly to a store, to a consumer, sold at a farm stand, that kind of thing. Then there are also some types of exemptions for products that are rarely consumed raw. And so we have several major commodities in Oregon that are exempt for that reason, potatoes, for example. And also products that go into processing that involves a kill step are exempt. So in terms of the benefits, this slide shows the costs, but FDA estimates that the final produce safety rule will help avoid 331,964 illnesses per year at a savings of $925 million. So, and again, there are some potential benefits in terms of avoided economic impacts from the cost to industry of outbreaks.
Yes, Senator.
Mm-hmm. Those benefits are, you just outlined were large numbers. Have we ever figured out, because that amount of compliance money, when you count it, multiply it times 3,000 or more farmers, becomes a very large number, too. What is the total compliance cost for the implementation of this bill, approximately?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Senator Roblin, I'll get that information to you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Make a note to do that. This slide just shows a few of the main provisions of the produce safety rule. As I just talked about, there are several important exemptions. And then there are provisions related to some of the different pathways that produce can become contaminated. So I won't go into each of these, but I just wanted to mention again that even though FDA, I think, made a great effort to listen to the feedback from states and stakeholders during the rulemaking process, the more we came to understand the final version of their produce safety rule, the more concerns we continued to have with the agricultural water portion of that rule. And so FDA has recently agreed to take another look at that portion of the rule, and we're very grateful for that. So we hope it will be more workable for our growers.
Thank you. Stephanie, could you just give us an example of a problem? What is the problem with the agricultural rule?
Mr. Chair, the rule would have required extensive monitoring, particularly for growers that use surface water sources. And so one of our concerns was that, for example, our growers in the Treasure Valley in Ontario area, they take water off of miles and miles of canals and drains. And so if a grower had, for example, 20 fields with 20 different canals supplying each field, they would have had to take 5 water samples per year from each of those locations. And so it not only represented a significant cost for the lab analysis and the time to gather those samples, but the lab method, the only lab method that was allowed to analyze those samples, had only a 6-hour holding time, which would be very impractical for some of our rural producers. And it's not a method that's currently used by any analytical laboratories in Oregon. So, and just a West Side example, if somebody has a bunch of different irrigation ponds that they use, or again, streams and rivers that they pull off of, they would have had to sample each of those 5 samples per year. They wouldn't have been able to use other data necessarily that were being gathered by other agencies. And so we saw quite a few concerns with the way it was shaping up.
So how do you then ascertain the quality of the water that's going into the field? Mm-hmm. I mean, how would you get at potential contamination mm-hmm. from animals or whatever gets into it?
Mr. Chair, another piece of the rule that I think is good and could stay in there is an assessment. The grower is expected to do an assessment of potential sources of contamination for each of their water sources. The bigger the canal system, for example, the more challenging that gets. I don't think we're proposing eliminating sampling, but just the rate, the amount of sampling was excessive, I think, was our concern. So there's some other certification programs, for example, that might require 1 to 3 samples a year, or they're more flexible in terms of allowing growers to do an assessment but not specifying the number of samples that need to be gathered.
Thank you. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you talk water samples from water sources, is that there's no proviso for if you water 6 fields from 1 water source, just the source needs to be checked?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that's correct. If you pump off of one source off of the river, for example, and then deliver that in a network of pipes where there's not a potential source of contamination between the diversion point and the field, then you would just need to take one set of samples.
A follow-up?
Yes.
When you have biological discharge, say, from a sanitary sewer plant mm-hmm. upstream from where they draw from, is there any process to look at that the federal government or you would look at to say, wait a minute, now you're watering your field with sewer water that's been treated but put in, and several times we have overflows, and so do you take that into account?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I think the total maximum daily load process, which is operated by the Department of Environmental Quality, would ensure the quality of the normal discharge water would meet water quality standards. But certainly, if someone was irrigating, say, for frost protection during a cold period and then it rained and there was a sewage overflow, when the produce was actually growing and the harvestable portion of the crop was present, that's certainly a concern that the grower would be expected to take into account.
Thank you.
Yes,
one other one on that one. So we have a unique system in our cranberry bogs down on the coast. So the top harvest there first, they pass the water onto the next. Would each field have to test it each time? Because the possibility of having something, birds, for example, because we have a lot of birds. So would each successive group that used the water have to have it tested?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Senator Roblin, I think that's a really good one that we probably haven't encountered before. I would note that cranberries are exempt as a type of produce that's rarely consumed raw, but I would say another thing we're seeing is that some buyers of produce are expecting their suppliers to show compliance whether or not they're technically covered by the rule, and that's a market decision. So I think it would be good for us to find out the answer to that.
Thank you.
So we can provide that to FDA.
Don't get bogged down in it.
Well, that's right. College professors, they always come up with that kind of stuff.
Afternoon humor.
Just one more provision of the rule I'll note before I move on is that there are training requirements. There is a requirement for the operator or the person in charge to take an accredited produce safety training. Currently, there's one accredited type of curriculum that was developed by the Produce Safety Alliance, and they're in the process of training and accrediting lead trainers across the country that can then deliver the training to growers.
And so what is the requirement then for growers to, that is there a certain number of hours they have to take or?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is they just need to attend an approved training curriculum. The produce safety training, the one that is currently accredited, is a one-day long training that it consists of, I believe, 7 modules that go through the different sections of the produce safety rule.
And so presumably they just have to have somebody from their operation who is designated as the safety person who will go to it?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair.
Do we have a complete definition for produce? Did I miss that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, there is a list in the beginning of the final rule of produce that is covered and produce that is exempt. So, and it is crop by crop, basically, crop type by crop type.
So, follow up? Mm-hmm. So, like, around me, they farm turnips and parsnips and rutabaga. Would that fall in the produce category?
Chair Denbrough, Senator Olson, I believe all of those are exempt because they're all considered rarely consumed raw. We can confirm that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We'll just get the list and share it.
Yes.
We bring in a lot of the same produce that we produce here in this country from other countries. They do not have the same requirements, or do they? And how are they being checked as opposed to our stuff?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roblin, great question. One of the 7 rules that FDA adopted is called the Foreign Supplier Verification Program Rule, and that is intended to subject international producers to the same standards that domestic producers are held to. There's a different verification system than there is domestically because, of course, FDA can't do inspections in a foreign country. Basically, domestic buyers are required to keep records from their international suppliers showing that those suppliers are in compliance with the applicable rules, whether that's the produce safety rule or the preventive controls rule.
Okay.
And do you, I don't know if this is something you know the answer to, but how do our, you know, the imported produce compare to our domestically created, you know, in terms of problems with outbreaks and, you know, contaminated crops? Do we know how, you know, the relative safety stacks up?
Mr. Chair, we can get some statistics for you about that. Yeah, we'll find out.
Sorry, excuse me, Lindsay Ang, for the record, with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, Chair Dumbro. One thing that I would say is that before the Food Safety Modernization Act passed, the liability for any outbreaks associated with foreign produce would have gone to that foreign firm, and so it was very difficult for FDA to track those down. So one of the big changes with the Food Safety Modernization Act and the foreign supplier verification rule is that the importer here in the U.S. is now legally liable for the safety of that product. And so I would imagine that the statistics on, and our ability to track that is a lot better now that they have a direct domestic connection there. Before, they had a lot of trouble trying to track it down.
That sounds like a great change.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, sorry.
No, it's great. Okay, and this slide just has a quick summary of those rules for manufactured or processed foods. They're called the preventive controls rules. They include both updates to basic sanitation requirements for processing firms, and then they require a hazard identification and mitigation process. It's basically a planning process and then a monitoring and follow-up process that firms covered by the rules need to follow. And there are a couple sectors of the industry that are already following this type of process. And I would also say many large food processors have voluntarily adopted this process, but juice and seafood are already required to go through this type of process. There are some exemptions for small businesses under preventive controls. There are significant monitoring and record keeping requirements. One thing we'll note is there are a couple new types of ag businesses that are affected in addition to food processors, and those are packing houses and mint stills. So we've talked extensively with the mint folks. They've been great about including us at their annual meetings, and we've had some packing establishments involved in our comments on the rules over the last few years. In addition, feed mills will also be affected by the rules. So we have quite a few small feed mills in the state that are inspected currently by our commercial feed program.
So produce that is usually not ingested raw mm-hmm. are exempt, but mint stills are not? Because that's being...
Chair Dumbro, Senator Roebling. Produce that's rarely consumed raw is exempt from the produce safety rule, okay. But the processor of that produce would be covered by the preventive controls rule. So, for example, ocean spray, if they're processing cranberry juice, would be covered either by the juice safety requirements or by this rule, depending on what they're doing.
Okay.
So let me throw another one at you. We had last summer or spring, there was a listeria outbreak mm-hmm. out in eastern Oregon. It actually happened right after I took a group of constituents, visited mm-hmm. Three Mile Canyon Farm, had a great tour mm-hmm. there, learned a lot. It was great. But then there was just a week later this listeria outbreak, which I think actually, although it was Oregon produce, maybe the packing was processing was over in Washington mm-hmm. State. Mm-hmm. And it just got me wondering, how do the two states sort of coordinate for something like that, where you have produce from one state and processing from another? Who oversees that? And do we have a sense of what went wrong there?
Mr. Chair, I will say that listeria is a very difficult bacteria to keep out of food processing establishments. It's one that takes hold in a pretty clean establishment when other pathogens have been removed and destroyed. I would say that the preventive controls rule, part of the process, I think, that businesses are expected to go through is identifying those hazards and then determining how are they going to monitor for those hazards, what are they going to do if they find them. And so a typical way that a processing establishment would deal with listeria is to do environmental monitoring, and that means swabbing of food contact surfaces, belts, and other types of equipment, as well as areas in the plant where food isn't going to come in contact, but they could make their way to food contact surfaces. So an FDA has just released a draft revised approach for businesses to deal with Listeria. I think it really supports a seek and destroy approach where a business could do very thorough monitoring, and if they find Listeria, there are some options that they have to deal with it. In terms of how the states collaborate to deal with a pathogen that's found, I think the business would take the lead in determining the recall. The state and most likely Food and Drug Administration would look at the firm's records to see where the product came from and where it went. And then they would notify the affected states so that we could reach out if we needed to and notify downstream users of the product if we needed to notify folks about a recall. So even though many businesses have been following components of these rules for years, the produce rule in particular, but many of the other rules will have a significant impact to businesses in Oregon. And some of the main needs that I think we've identified and in collaboration with stakeholders for the rules to really be successful, particularly for the produce industry, are extensive outreach. I think a lot of folks out there probably still don't know that the rule is in place. Training, again, to help meet the training that is required by the rule. On-site technical assistance, going onto a farm or going into a packing house and helping the business understand what they need to do to come into compliance with the rule. And then in some cases, capital and operational improvements will be needed, and those will represent significant costs either for processors or farms.
So do you partner with the Ag Extension Service to get this information out?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. Extension has invited us several times to meetings, for example, of berry growers that they help coordinate. Extension and actually Oregon State University have received a grant to help provide some of the training on the produce safety rule. And we just recently met with OSU a couple of weeks ago to talk about who is doing what with respect to training. I would also say, though, that providing the level and the volume of training that is going to be needed is a challenge for many states when it comes to extension, just because of the capacity limitations that they have and the other demands on their time. So in terms of ODA's role with produce safety, we last fall received a FDA grant, and it's $3.5 million over a five-year period to conduct outreach, to provide one-on-one technical assistance to farmers and packers. And one of the things that was required as a condition of getting this grant to conduct an inventory of farms and provide inventory information to the Food and Drug Administration. That is voluntary on the farm's part. There is no registration requirement for produce farms that was adopted as part of the Food Safety Modernization Act. We plan to hire 3 staff as part of implementing this grant, and we have a recruitment open right now for one of the staff. For the training piece, we plan to rely predominantly on our partners to provide classroom training. We think that's a strength that our partners have, and whereas our strengths are the outreach and that one-on-one assistance. One decision that we're still deciding on is whether or not to apply for the funds for inspections. There's a separate pot of funding from FDA for states that want to take on the regulatory role with respect to implementing this rule. We wanted to have the conversation with you prior to making that decision. In addition, we're waiting to see how the final ag water rules come out before we can communicate them to growers. We need to understand what they are.
Do you have an ETA for that?
Mr. Chair, not at this time.
Yes, Senator Burke.
Is this a part of the conversation that you're having with the Board of Agriculture to make recommendations to us? Because I would feel uncomfortable knowing if I want you to take that over without having some input from.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Roblin, our board passed a resolution last June, I believe it was, Recommending that ODA wait to apply for inspection funds until we got a little more details about how the process was going to work and just to see what we could learn from other states' experience. So that's a great point. On the preventive control side, I think our role on the regulatory piece is a little more clear. Generally, in our food safety program, we adopt a variety of federal rules by reference. For example, currently in our food safety rules for processing establishments, we've adopted a variety of rules for low acid canning, for example, by reference. So we're just referencing that code of federal regulations, and then we're inspecting for compliance with those regulations. And so it is likely that we will at some point adopt the preventive controls rule by reference for manufacturing facilities. We may be asked to conduct FDA contract inspections to that rule. Those are state inspections where we submit a report to the FDA. And so that's something we may be asked to do. One challenge that we're facing is that each of those inspections will likely take about twice the time that it currently takes, and that's because of the extensive records review that we would likely have to do. On the animal food side, same thing. We may adopt that new rule by reference and conduct manufacturing inspections to FDA requirements, so that remains to be seen, depending on the resources available to do that work.
This may be a question for Lindsay, but how much animal food manufacturing do we do in this state?
Mr. Chair, we have a number of small feed mills, and I can get you more statistics shortly. But in addition, we have a lot of food processing establishments that recycle byproducts. So, for example, beer brewing establishments, spent grains go to livestock feed, food processing, potato or French fry plants, for example, byproducts go into animal feed. So if you draw the boundaries around it widely, there is a significant amount of feed that is manufactured in the state.
Pretty soon it'll be cider, right? Mm-hmm. Cider residue.
Yes, without a doubt.
And so just to summarize again, these rules will have a significant impact on our ag and food industries. And there are a variety of ways that the industry could use assistance in terms of implementing and complying with the rules. We're still determining our role in terms of inspections, particularly with respect to the produce safety rule. And I'll transition into talking about Senate Bill 18, our bill that would provide that framework for ODA to participate, both in terms of inspections in addition to the voluntary work that we've taken on with this FDA grant.
Yeah, we will in a sec. But let me just ask, and I'm sure it's too early for you to answer, but are you getting any signals about changes in approach given the new administration? And I think, has the FDA head been appointed yet, or has he or she been confirmed?
Mr. Chair?
Mm. Very much in process.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I'm not sure about Health and Human Services Secretary Price. I'm not sure if he's been confirmed or not.
We can find out.
Yeah, no, I'm just wondering if there's any indications of, are there going to be changes in approach to this program that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of. I was at a national meeting for grant recipients for the produce safety rule, and FDA leadership was a part of that meeting last week, and we didn't hear any indication that there was going to be a change of direction. I think we heard a lot of uncertainties about funding later on in the future, but that was the main thing that we heard.
Colleagues, any other questions, sort of big picture questions about this? Okay, then you all going to stay there and talk about the bill? Okay, so I'll close the information hearing on Federal Food Safety Modernization Act, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 18. And Cheyenne, tell us what this bill will do.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 18 designates Oregon Department of Agriculture as the state agency having the primary responsibility to administer and enforce the duties, functions, and powers imposed on or granted to state agencies under the Federal Food Safety Modernization Act. There are specific authorizations. There is also a Dash 2 amendment, comes from ODA, that reorganizes, cleans up, has the same effect as the original measure. There is no subsequent referral.
Okay, thank you. Stephanie?
Mm-hmm. Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, Senate Bill 18 would essentially give ODA the authority to conduct inspections on farms for compliance with the produce safety rule and to conduct a variety of other activities to support implementation, including entering into agreements with partner organizations. One other important thing that the bill would do would be to give us the authority to adopt the produce safety rule by reference to conduct rulemaking. So that's the produce safety piece. And then on the commercial feed side, it makes some minor changes to our definition of commercial feed in order to bring our laws more in conformance with federal law and authority. Now that the Animal Food Preventive Controls Rule is in place, it would basically give us authority to deal with adulterated products that are used as animal food without the requirement for some of those products to become licensed or have to register as commercial feed.
What would be an example of that?
Mr. Chair, one example could be a food processing byproduct. Another great example that our feed specialist has used is melamine, for example. When melamine came into Oregon during the issues a few years ago, he was able to embargo the melamine because it was intended for use as an ingredient in commercial feed. However, had it been fed on its own to animals and not an ingredient of commercial feed, we would not have had the authority to deal with it. And so this would give us the authority to deal with that kind of byproduct or product without requiring it to register as a feed or pay a fee for registration. I'm happy to go through the sections of the bill with you, or I can just take questions, whatever the committee would prefer.
Colleagues, you have any questions? My quick look at the bill suggests that it just follows these issues that you've just shared with us.
Yeah. Authorization, isn't it?
Yeah. I would rather not personally adopt every rule that the federal government has. I'd let them work on the rules as opposed to us going through all of those, and I think this does that.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much,
thank you.
All three of you. So I have no one signed up to speak to Senate Bill 18. Is there anyone here who really regrets that they didn't sign up and would like to speak to Senate Bill 18? Okay, seeing none, I'll close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 18, and colleagues will schedule a work session sometime soon on this. So let's open our public hearing on Senate Bill 812, and we will call on Senator Septic to present this bill to us. Yes, that's great. Yes, we have the CEO of Septic Systems here.
Oh, okay. I'll take the middle chair. So we could have an explanation. I don't want to say anything.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Senate Bill 812 specifies that a purpose for which septic system loan funds may be used is to conduct a regional evaluation of community on-site septic systems to determine whether repair or replacement is necessary. It requires grant agreements stipulate that a loan must be used to connect a small business or residence with a damaged, malfunctioning, or inoperable system to a sewer if it's available and if the home or business is required to connect. It allows loans for less than 100% of the costs if the borrower requests that and consents to a loan that covers a lower percentage of costs, declares emergency, is effective on passage, has no subsequent referral.
Thank you, Cheyenne. Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough and Vice Chair Olson and the rest of the committee. For the record, my name is Arnie Roblin, Senate District 5. As you know, when you pass bills, and last year was the first time we got to pass our septic bill, it sometimes gets messy, and you missed a few little things. You thought you had a perfect bill that would not need any corrections, and then after you implement it, you find that, like septic systems, they can sometimes be messy. And so we looked around for a few things that could make this bill even more perfect. And we recognized that one of the things that we had thought about what we had done, or I thought we had done, was to say if you have a sewer system that's been installed where you have a septic system and your septic goes out, we really want you to connect. That's really the important part. It would be much better to connect than putting in a new septic system. And so this gets specific to say if you are in a place where that's at, you can get the loan to connect to the septic system. I think a good improvement. We kind of thought we had done that, but I think this makes it clear that you're going to do it. Number two, if you read the bill exactly as it was written, which is what people do after the bill gets done, you find that it says you have to take a loan out for the full amount of the septic system. It doesn't give you an option. Say you've been saving money thinking you had some money saved up to pay for your septic, and then you get your bill for the septic and it's bigger than you have, and so you want to have a loan that's less than the full amount. The previous bill, the way it was worded, we're not sure you had the right to do that. You had to take the whole amount. I guess then you could try to pay it back, but this makes it clear that you can, with approval of the owner, you can give them less than the full amount of money for the septic system. And the other one has to do with checking to see whether or not it needs to be replaced, or does the system just, can it be just refurbished? And I think Vice Chair Olson explained last time that there are ways in which you can fix a system if it's clogged, as opposed to just replacing the whole thing, but you need to have somebody engineering look at that and make that decision. And we added the word community, because there are some of our communities that have community buildings and stuff that have septic systems, and we wanted those places, I think, to also be available for the loan program as we develop it and get more money into the program. So for that, I think we have cleared up any little problems we may have had with our septic system in the past, and look forward to having any questions, and I'll let the other people speak to this.
So. Yeah. John? Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Audley. I'm here on behalf of Kraft 3. Adam Zimmerman, President and CEO of Kraft 3, regrets he was unable to join us today, and sadly you get me instead of Adam. I'll do my best to answer your questions, especially those from Senator Olson. Kraft 3 is a certified development financial institution serving the Pacific Northwest for over 20 years. During that time, it's quietly invested over $400 million in small business loans and consumer loans designed to promote healthier families, resilient communities, and stronger natural systems. I have a couple of main points. The first is, this program is, in our view, a great example of what an effective partnership between a government and a government goal and a nonprofit organization charged with administering it. You take a small amount of public funds, you leverage private capital to increase the dollars available, and you deliver faster and more efficiently to Oregonians across the state. That's what's happened with this program. We do it in a way that insulates the state from fiscal exposure and arguably political risk associated with picking winners and losers. As the senator has just referenced, it's also a good example of how important it is to try out a program before you fully invest in it. We identified a couple of problems, not big problems, but problems worth fixing, especially related to the fact that not all customers want or need to borrow the full amount. Nearly half of the customers served so far, and it's a small pool, there's about 15 so far across the state, are considered low-income families, and it's good that they have access to 100% if that's what they need. But about 46% of the customers so far have not necessarily needed that. The requirement has been to loan them the full amount. And finally, the last point I want to emphasize is that when you get a policy right, it earns strong bipartisan support. There is broad constituency support for these technical changes, along with Craft 3, as you'll see in a letter before you. Endorsing organizations include the City of Bend, the Association of Oregon Counties, the Oregon Environmental Council, the Oregon Association of Clean Water Agencies, the League of Oregon Cities, Oregon Water Utility Council, Special Districts Associations of Oregon, and the League of Women Voters of Oregon. So I think y'all did a great job. We're just looking for a couple of technical fixes so that we can hopefully continue to administer this program successfully. I'll do my best to answer questions. Thank you for inviting me to speak to you.
Hey, thank you, John. Karen, did you have something?
Yes, Chair Dembro, members of the committee, Karen Tarno with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I'm here today to say that our agency supports this bill. I think these gentlemen have said enough about the details of the bill, and we think these are good fixes. We're very, very happy with the way the program's being implemented and think this is a very effective and cost-effective partnership between our agency and Craft 3. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Questions? Yes,
of course.
Since there's no one else, I'll call on Senator Olson.
I can raise my hand now.
Just a simple question, John. In the other bill, they had to borrow the full amount, and usually that is prescribed an interest rate predicated on the amount. If they only have to borrow half, does that interest rate change, or are they still allowed to get it at the same rate as a big loan?
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, I don't believe so. The interest rates are calculated for different reasons other than the amount, based on what I know. Right now, and I actually asked them to share them with me because we didn't quite have those numbers the last time we visited. 20% of the loans so far have been made at a fully deferred interest rate of 1.99%. So for folks at the low end of the income scale, they're getting a fully deferred loan at less than 2%. A quarter of folks have received interest-only loans at just a hair less than 4%. And 55% of folks have paid 4.99% and made monthly principal and interest loan payments. That's based on their assessment of your risk as a customer. Another thing that I think is important to emphasize is that while the transaction is between the lender and the borrower, The funds actually go to the contractor, and that's a way to insulate against, make sure that the money is spent in the fashion it was intended. If there's a different answer to your question about change in interest rate, I'll get it back to you, but I don't think so.
It doesn't sound like there is. It sounds like you're pretty consistent, but sometimes, if you want to go in and borrow on a car and you're going to pay the full amount,
right,
retail sticker price, they give you a great interest rate.
Right.
If you're going to pay $20,000 for that, they jack the rate up to make a little differential. And I just wondered if, in fact, with this program, it seems like it's a very reasonable program, if that was the case. And apparently it doesn't seem to be, because 4.99 is not astronomical.
I'll check to make sure and submit a written response from the people who really know.
Thank you.
Okay.
No.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you,
all three of you. Okay, anybody else who wants to talk about this subject, Senate Bill 812? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 812, and colleagues will try to get the paperwork going to do a work session on this soon.
Thanks a lot for that, Senator Rowland.
You're welcome.
Okay, so close the public hearing on Senate Bill 812, and we have no more business before us today. Colleagues, on Wednesday we will be talking about the diesel engine bill, so we will, I think, have a full hearing that day. So enjoy the time off. With that, we are adjourned.
Thanks. Thanks.
With that, we are adjourned.